a bipartisan system of legalized bribery.
The problem that we write about is not exclusively caused by Republicans by any means whatsoever. In fact, we take no prisoners in the book. We write about Democrats almost as much, if not more, than Republicans who, as we write, are on the take. We write about how during the Clinton administration, the president, vice president, and a few others decided to try to compete with Republicans in terms of attracting corporate money. And what we have seen since then is kind of an arms race. Each party wants to collect and spend at least as much as the opposing party.
That's Wendell Potter. We talk with him about the book he co-wrote with Nick Penniman, Nation on the Take: How Big Money Corrupts Our Democracy and What We Can Do About It. Then, Bernie Sanders supporters have been charging the DNC with bias against their candidate for months, only to be called conspiracy theorists by corporate media pundits. Now, WikiLeaks has released 20,000 emails showing Bernie supporters were right, but those same pundits are dismissing it as no big deal.
It's what I call the Snowden cycle, or the Edward Snowden cycle, where people assume something's true and they're kind of dismissed as being a conspiracy theorist or nutty, and then their claims are later turn out to be true, and the response is, oh, well, of course it's true, and it's actually not very newsworthy.
That's journalist Adam Johnson. We talk with him about the corporate spin on the WikiLeaks DNC revelations. His article for the Media Watch Group Fair is "With DNC Leaks, Former Conspiracy Theory is Now True and No Big Deal." That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station and at writersvoice.net. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon. Lobbying is the third largest industry in our nation's capital, behind government and tourism. And it's not just Washington, D.C. The system of legalized bribery pervasive in government is as bad, if not worse, in the states. It's what has turned our democracy into an oligarchy that functions only for the 1%. Instead of working for us, our elected representatives spend most of their time dialing for dollars from wealthy and corporate donors. A Princeton study that examined more than 1,800 policy initiatives from 1981 to 2002 showed that those favored by the wealthy were enacted, while those favored by most voters, like single-payer health care or action on the environment, were ignored. And that was before Citizens United tilted the playing field even further. My guest, Wendell Potter, once was a lobbyist for one of the most powerful industries in our economy, the health insurance industry. We last spoke with him in 2012 about his expose of that industry's influence peddling, Deadly Spin. Now he's teamed up with Nick Penniman on a book that takes the expose of lobbying to a much wider level, Nation on the Take: How Big Money Corrupts Our Democracy and What We Can Do About It. Wendell Potter, welcome to Writer's Voice. Welcome back to Writer's Voice.
Well, thank you. Glad to be back.
Yeah, we spoke to you back in 2012 about your last book, Deadly Spin, and this is like a more generalized extension of some of the things you began to talk about in that book, Nation on the Take: How Big Money Corrupts Our Democracy. It's just a terrific book. I thought I was pretty well educated on the topic. I learned so much more than I ever imagined by reading this wonderful book.
You're right. It kind of picks up where Deadly Spin left off, and it looks at other industries. Deadly Spin was somewhat more of a my personal story as well, and I wrote a lot about my time in the health insurance industry. And in this book, we go, when I say we, my co-author and I, Nick Penniman, we look at other industries as well, too, to show how just about every industry, every company, is able to influence public policy in ways that benefit those companies, and often to the disadvantage of regular Americans.
Right. I mean, this book is really about money in politics. You say it's creating a governing crisis that's paralyzing the country. That sounds very real to us, and you say that we pay a price for this. So start with a little bit about how we got to where we are. I want to focus mostly on the current situation, but you have the first couple of chapters in the book do talk about how we got here. So I wonder if you could hit some highlights.
I will. In fact, the first part of the book is sort of like how we got here, and it provides a historical perspective, looking back at times in our history when we've seen situations sort of like what we are seeing now. During the Gilded Age, at the turn of the 20th century, we write about the important role that Teddy Roosevelt played back then in his campaign against the robber barons, and we frankly have we could call the current age the second Gilded Age. Because once again, very powerful and entrenched special interest, and a few very wealthy billionaires are able to influence public opinion, influence public policy, and influence elections in ways that are very detrimental to our democracy and to individual Americans. And the middle part of the book is about that. It shows how we are disadvantaged, how we are all affected, and what we can do about it. But we got here because we frankly weren't paying a lot of attention as Washington really became almost overcome, if you will, by or at least flooded with lobbying firms, and we've seen far more members of Congress and their staffs go into lobbying right after they leave office. Often they leave office soon or retire or resign just so they can take a very high-paying job as a lobbyist.
The famous revolving door.
Right, exactly.
Yeah, you actually say that the influence industry is the third largest industry in D.C. behind government itself and tourism.
Right.
That's really shocking. This influence industry, it's made up of lobbyists. Give us a little bit of a picture of just how big it is.
Well, yeah, and I would posit that in a few years, if we don't do something about this, then the influence peddling industry, if you will be dominant in Washington, D.C. It certainly has grown very rapidly to be number three right now behind government and tourism. During the John F. Kennedy administration, for example, there were just a handful, just hundreds. You really could list all the lobbyists on a couple pages of paper. Now there are thousands of lobbyists in Washington. And it's also important to point out that we're not talking just about Washington either. We're talking and we write about what goes on in state capitals and, in many cases, municipal governments. The influence peddling is not exclusive to Washington by any means. And in fact, more often than not, the lobbyists are even more successful in state capitals because there's even less scrutiny, less of a media watchdog role in many state capitals.
You know, very recently, Debbie Wasserman Schultz, who is the head of the DNC, the Democratic National Committee, decided to overturned something that Obama had put in. He had banned lobbyists. Now, I'm not sure I have this totally correct, but I believe he banned lobbyists from contributing to electoral campaigns, and she has suspended it for the DNC. I wonder, can you say something about this and what the impact of that might be having on our current primary election cycle now?
Well, it's important to know that the problem that we write about is not exclusively caused by Republicans by any means whatsoever. In fact, we take no prisoners in the book. We write about Democrats almost as much, if not more, than Republicans who, as we write, are on the take. We write about how during the Clinton administration, the president, vice president, and a few others, their friends or like-minded politicians from southern states decided to try to compete with Republicans in terms of attracting corporate money. They saw that they were not getting as much money from unions as they once had been, and they felt they needed to have a new source of revenue. And so that's when it really began, and what we have seen since then is kind of an arms race. Each party wants to collect and spend at least as much as the opposing party. And that's what we have going on right now. And until we can do something about this to disarm, that's going to continue. The Democrats will continue to try to attract as much corporate money and money from rich donors as they possibly can until we do something about it.
I interviewed Wendell Potter about Nation on the Take before Bernie Sanders endorsed Clinton. Bernie's campaign was notable for being funded almost entirely by millions of small donations, not corporate interests. I asked Potter whether he thought this could be an alternative model going forward.
Well, clearly it is. We've seen quite a phenomenon with the support that Senator Sanders has been receiving, and the many thousands of small donations that his campaign has received. It's just been refreshing and telling that campaigns can be financed with small donors. And in fact, that's something that Nick Peniman and I write about. We are advocating more citizen-funded campaigns, and we point to states and New York City being one, and cities, New York City being one of them, where it really works, where people can see that their small donations can be matched by a public fund that has been created to help finance campaigns, and not only do people who are ordinary Americans, not only can their voice be amplified, but it dilutes the power to a certain extent of the very wealthy. And politicians, those who are running for office, are very grateful for that kind of a system because it enables them to get off of the treadmill. As we write in the book, members of Congress today spend about half of their time not working for us, not on constituent service, not holding hearings, not on the floor of the House, or even in their own offices. They leave the Capitol building, they go to the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee offices, or the Republican equivalent, which is nearby, and they go to cubicles and do nothing but dial for dollars, mm-hmm. hours and hours a day, every day that they're in Washington.
And yet it seems so entrenched, one would think that they would welcome the chance not to do this, and yet they seem to be fighting so hard to continue to. How does this corruption, because it seems like it is corruption, it's legalized bribery, how does it kind of capture the very ethos of people who have come to be public servants?
Well, people, I think a lot of people go into public service with the right attitude and a desire to really serve constituents. And I think many of them are absolutely gobsmacked to find out just the way the real world operates. We write about a memo that incoming freshmen got from the Democratic Congressional Committee a couple of years ago, suggesting what an ideal day or an ideal day from their perspective would look like. And members, you know, these newly elected members of Congress were just startled that the suggestion was that they spend so much time every day dialing for dollars. So it's not welcome. They don't like it. They hate having to do this. It's demeaning, and certainly not what they signed on for. Mm-hmm. But they don't see a way out. And that's what Nick and I write about. We point the path forward and how we can get out of this mess.
Well, before we get to it, and that is a very interesting section, because after reading your book, but before I got to the part of what we can do about it, it just seemed hopeless. The influence is so great. In fact, you cite a study, and I've seen this study as well, which is truly shocking, that said that it compared public opinion polls to policy preferences of the elites. We're talking about the corporations, the banks, and measured both against which policy actually became law.
Yeah.
Tell us about that and its conclusions, about that study.
Yeah, the study showed that you can almost always count on the special interest winning the day and always being able to win out over the interest of consumers. And one of the reasons is that consumer advocates have very few resources compared to the corporate interest, and so they're just swamped. They don't really have a chance in many cases. So it's pretty easy to see why corporate interest usually prevail. They're able to develop sophisticated talking points and materials and make sure that many, many lobbyists come to the congressional offices and present the point of view, and that just doesn't. There's no equivalent of that because of a lack of resources on the side of consumers.
Yeah, you say something like 80% of the money comes from corporations, only 20% from unions and public
right.
interest groups.
Right.
You know, Hillary Clinton has said that, well, yeah, she takes money from Wall Street. All politicians do, except, of course, her opponent doesn't. And that it does not influence how she votes, that she has never changed a vote because of it. Now, you were a health industry lobbyist at one time. Is that correct? Can I call
yeah,
you
I've
that?
Done some, well, I have done some lobbying in my past, and I know how it works. And we're not talking necessarily about a quid pro quo every time. There's not that that legalized bribery of, in which a business person would write a check and say, I'm writing this so that you will vote X way or on a piece of legislation. That's not what we're talking about. We're talking about the buying of influence. And so the money that, like the big banks, put into lobbying, that helps to set the environment in Washington. Their point of view is more loudly heard. And over time, the chances are that whether Hillary Clinton herself might vote sometimes against the desires of a particular industry that's donated to her campaigns. There's also a greater likelihood, if you looked at her voting records, that she probably also has voted with the industry a number of times when, in an analysis of the votes, you could say that the way she voted was more for the interest of the special interest than to her constituents.
Yeah, and in fact, I think that study that we talked about, it showed that there's only 18% of the time that when there is a policy that is overwhelmingly supported by the American people but opposed by the elites, that it ever passes. And
right.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think that was pretty telling. Not to talk too much about Hillary Clinton, but she also has brought up the issue of Dodd-Frank. She has said, you know, that now you spend a certain amount of time in the book, a very interesting amount of time, on the bank bailout and showing how it showed the influence of big money. Well, why don't we go over that just briefly, and then I'm going to follow up with a question about Dodd-Frank.
Right. And I might go back to have another thought about what Senator Clinton or Secretary Clinton has said about her vote not being influenced. It's more nuanced than that. And that we write about, I've written quite a bit about the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare, and she's expressed support for that and continuing it. And I have myself written very positively of the Affordable Care Act as well as critically. Critically, because it doesn't do nearly enough for solving the problems that we have in our healthcare system. The reality is that law would never have been enacted had lawmakers and the president not taken into consideration first and foremost the interest of the special interest. In other words, the pharmaceutical industry had to be satisfied or they would have thrown so much money at it it would have killed the law or the bill. Same with the physician lobby and the medical device manufacturers, the hospitals, the insurance companies. All of them had to be reassured that the legislation as passed would protect their interests. The Affordable Care Act in and of itself props up the way our healthcare system is structured. It doesn't really transform it by any means. It's been helpful, but that just gives you an idea of how thinking is influenced on Capitol Hill and on Pennsylvania Avenue.
Right. I mean, Obama actually came out during his campaign very much. He pledged to put price controls on drugs. I mean, you tell a very emblematic story, the story of Bill Wildrick, who has hepatitis C. Why don't you tell us a story as an example of what you're talking about and how Obamacare really has, you know, lined the pockets of the drug industry. Well, actually, the drug prescription, the Medicare Part D, has done
right.
that.
Yeah, Bill and Faith Wilderick live in Pennsylvania, where I live. I've met them. They both work for the same company. Very middle class, hardworking people who are finding it very hard to make ends meet because of the high deductibles they have to meet to be able to get the drugs, the medications that Bill needs. He did have hepatitis C, and his physicians recommended Sovaldi, which is a fairly new medication that is marketed by Gilead, which is a pharmaceutical company. And that company decided to price that medication at $84,000 for 12 weeks of treatment, which is just extraordinary. It is not based on the value necessarily of the drug or how much it cost to produce, but on really what the market, what Gilead felt the market would bear in this country. They charge far less for it in other countries because of policies that are in place to keep companies from gouging consumers. But as a consequence of our lack of appropriate regulation, these companies can get away with what they're getting away with. And Bill and Faith worry that, boy, if she loses her job, what in the world are they going to be doing? They have insurance. And even with insurance, and they're making premium payments every month, even with that, they can't take a vacation. They don't go out to eat. All their money goes to the co-payments and co-insurance that they have to pay because of the gouging of the pharmaceutical industry.
Yes, and also, you talk in the book, Wendell Potter, in Nation on the Take, as we're talking here about drug prices, that, first of all, the whole idea that prices have to be so high because of research is not entirely true.
No, it's not true. It's a talking point that the industry has used for many, many years, and most Americans regrettably seem to fall for it. The pharmaceutical companies say that they have to charge what they charge, otherwise the pipeline of new medications will dry up. It's just nonsense. The drug companies spend more on advertising, sales and advertising, than they spend on research and development. And here's the other fact that most Americans, I don't think, know. Most of the original research is not done by the drug companies. It's done by taxpayers, by the National Institutes of Health, for example, and at universities that get taxpayer support. So much of the research is done at the taxpayer's expense. Much of the development is done by drug companies. They take the work that universities and the NIH have done, and then they take that and work to develop medications from that research. But most of the cost of research is borne by taxpayers. So that's just a bogus argument that the drug companies make.
And also generics. I mean, why is the cost of generics going so high? Why is the cost, how do they set the prices, not only of the drugs that are still under patent, but also of generics? Why the huge increase?
Well, once again, it's because the manufacturers of generics can pretty much set the price that they want to charge. And get away with it. And yes, the price of generics has been going up considerably, very rapidly in recent years. And again, it's because those manufacturers can raise those prices. There are no restraints on that in this country. To the point that people are having a hard time even affording generic medications. Another phenomenon that's been going on in the industry, called pay for delay, and that is what that means is that the brand drug companies, brand name drug companies, will make payments to generic drug companies to get them to delay making generics for an extended period of time. So, in other words, the generic companies are making money to wait until sometime in the future to even introduce their generics.
So the system seems pretty rigged. The only thing that can really change this is some kind of competition. There was a lot of talk of a public option in when Obamacare was being discussed, but that how did that get taken out of the equation?
Well, it was taken out because the insurance industry wanted it out. It became the number one target of the insurance industry. Yes, a lot of Democratic lawmakers and the president at one point had said we need to have the so-called public option to keep private insurance companies honest. And the way it would have worked, people would have had one more company or one more health plan to choose from than they currently have. It would have been a health plan that would have been operated by the government, but in every other respect, it would be operated sort of like a private plan. But the insurance industry didn't want to have the additional competition. They, in fact, they've been going the opposite direction. There's a lot of merger and acquisition activity in the insurance industry and has been for quite a few years. So the industry is consolidating. That gives them more power, and they certainly didn't want to have another competitor. So they were able to influence enough Democrats to see things from their perspective, and it was stripped out of the legislation before it reached the president's desk.
Right, I believe was that Max Baucus and Dick Gephardt.
Right.
It was
the Senate Finance Committee was finally where it was stripped out. The House version of the bill did include a public option, but when the senators were taking it up before final passage, it was taken out. And you know, the president is somewhat to blame too, even though he had campaigned in favor of it and said that he felt it was important. He really didn't go to bat for it. I talked to members of Congress during that time who were supportive of the public option, but they said the president wasn't giving them any cover. He was just kind of, in the words of one congresswoman, hanging them out to dry. So they were supporting it, but not getting the backup support from the president from a verbal point of view.
Yeah, in your book, I mean, some of the most liberal politicians, Cory Booker, I was really surprised to see that he is number two, just behind Mitch McConnell, in campaign contributions from the same industry, the health industry.
Right. Exactly. We take no prisoners in this book. We lay the facts out there. Cory Booker, yes, is right up there at the top, and not only from the pharmaceutical industry, but from financial services as well, too. He and many other Democrats take large sums of money from industry, and you know they might campaign as progressives, and probably in many respects are, but they take enormous amounts of money. One of the reasons New Jersey is the home of a lot of drug companies, and they want to make sure that Cory Booker is someone that they can count on when they need him.
So I'm just curious, you don't talk about this in the book because the focus is really on how this nation is on the take, but what do you think of a single-payer health care plan such as the one that's promoted by Bernie Sanders?
I think it would be a system that would be better than the one that we've got. I think the Democrats made a strategic error by not holding hearings on single-payer legislation at the beginning of the health care reform debate in 2009. Whether it would have passed, probably not, considering the makeup of Congress at the time. But I think they should have started with that. They should have held hearings. They should have explained how it works in other countries very, very well and why it could work here. Mm-hmm. It would be a challenge because of the special interest, and I've said many times that I think going to a single-payer system in this country is more difficult than a lot of people believe because of money and politics.
Could you say more about that?
Well, the insurance industry is obviously very opposed to single-payer health care. And as long as they are able to influence public policy, we're not going to get it at the state level or the federal level. I mean, just a few minutes ago, you were talking about how they were able to keep even the public option out of the legislation that went to the president's desk. If they were able to do that, you know they're going to be able to kill any effort, certainly at the federal level, to implement a single-payer plan. It might be the right thing for the country, but as long as the insurance industry opposes it, it's just not likely to happen unless there are enough Democrats elected to both the House and the Senate, and we have a president who is supportive of single-payer. All those stars have to align, and it's not just Democrats. They have to be Democrats or social Democrats or whatever Bernie Sanders calls himself that agree with him. A lot of the Democrats, I'll reiterate, a lot of the Democrats do not favor single-payer legislation. People need to know that, too. It's not just the Republicans who are the stumbling block. It's a lot of the Democrats, and the insurance industry knows that. They only need to have a handful of Democrats to vote the way they want them to vote to kill legislation that they don't like.
Wendell Potter. We'll talk more with him about the book he co-authored with Nick Penniman, Nation on the Take, after the break. Stick around.
I've got the world on a string, sitting on a rainbow. Got the string around my finger. What a world, what a life, I'm in love. I got a song that I sing, I can make the rain go anytime I move my finger. Lucky me, can't you see I'm in love? Life is a beautiful thing, as long as I hold the string.
Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. We're talking with Wendell Potter, co-author with Nick Penniman of Nation on the Take, How Big Money Corrupts Our Democracy and What We Can Do About It. It's about the system of legalized bribery that has turned our government from a democracy into an oligarchy by the undue influence of corporate lobbyists on our elected representatives. Strong words, but ones that are backed up by academic research, not to speak of the experience of the millions of Americans who see their policy preferences flushed down the tubes again and again, while those favoring the 1% skate into enactment. Before the break, we were talking about how legislation that is overwhelmingly favored by the American people is killed by the influence of corporate lobbyists. But increasingly, lobbyists are writing legislation that gets passed by the politicians who are in their pockets. And talking about killing legislation, you also talk in the book of creating legislation. You talk of the role of organizations like the American Legislative Exchange Council. You call them actually bill mills.
Right.
Tell us about that.
Yeah, the American Legislative Exchange Council is an outfit that was created with corporate money funded by, you know, Koch brothers money and other corporations that want to have some extra clout creating legislation in state governments. What happens is that the ALEC, as it's called, American Legislative Exchange Council, you know, they have lawyers on staff or that can contract with, who write what is referred to as model legislation that is blessed by the lobbyist for special interest or corporate interest, and those bills are introduced in multiple states at any given time, almost identical, and probably in most cases absolutely identical bills that, if passed, would serve the interest of the corporate benefactors. It's been going on for several years, mostly out of The media hadn't paid much attention to the organization until fairly recently, but they can get away with it. The bills they produce are usually introduced by lawmakers in the various states, and most people are completely unaware of where the bills came from.
A lot of them, like, for example, the voter ID laws that are now disenfranchising voters all over the place. So let's talk about what we can do about it. It does seem to be impossible, you know, for us to go up against this oligarchy that we have. But you do suggest some ways. You talk about four legislative fixes. Everyone participates, everyone knows, everyone plays by the same rules, and everyone is held accountable. So let's start at the top with that. Everyone participates.
Well, we advocate more citizen-funded campaigns. We use that term rather than public financing because we think it's more accurate. Citizens who are regular folks, like we've talked, should be able to make sure that their contributions count, that they're recognized. And so we advocate for more scenarios like in New York City, where individual donors can see their campaign contributions matched. For example, a New York City resident in the Bronx can write a check for $50 to a candidate of his or her choice, and it can be matched up to six times. So in other words, a $50 contribution can be the equivalent of a $350 mm-hmm. contribution. So that's what we're talking about. And there are other ways of getting there, and other cities and states are doing it. So we think that should be done on a national basis to give regular folks the chance for their contributions to count more than they currently do.
Okay, so now everyone knows.
Transparency is the kind of the buzzword here. We need to know, and we need to know in real time, who is making the campaign contributions. We have a problem with what's referred to as dark money. That needs to go away. And that was enabled by a Supreme Court decision that allows for corporations and wealthy folks, or anyone for that matter, to make donations to groups that are set up that get some tax benefits and are considered nonprofit organizations, and their identity doesn't need to be disclosed. So that is what is causing the problem with the so-called dark money. Billions of dollars can be funneled into these organizations, and no one knows where the money comes from. Even the donations that are made to campaigns, directly to campaigns, those contributions are ultimately disclosed, but they need to be disclosed in real time. We don't, as it currently is, in many cases, we don't know who is contributing to a campaign until an election is over.
Wow. Okay. Now, then we have number three. Everyone plays by the same rules. They don't play by the same rules now?
Yeah. In under this category, we're advocating for a change in rules pertaining to revolving door and lobbyists. In South Carolina, for example, since the 1990s, lobbyists have not been able to make campaign contributions, and it's worked well, and it's been upheld by the courts. We think that should be the case all over the country and certainly in Washington, that there should be a prohibition against lobbyists being able to write campaign checks or to bundle campaign checks. We think there should be a longer period, a so-called cooling-off period, between the time that a lawmaker leaves office and when he or she can go work as a lobbyist or in the lobbying business in Washington, certainly. That right now, about half of the members of Congress go into lobbying work and influence peddling after they leave office, which is a much, much, much greater percentage than it used to be. And it's because lobbying firms pay so much more than the federal government does.
I mean, I would imagine that if you could make a law saying that there's a lifetime ban on lobbying, you would have a lot more actual public servants standing for election.
You would have people who go into public service because they feel that they have something to offer and truly want to contribute, and not as a stepping stone to riches.
Okay, and then how about stronger ethics and lobbying laws?
Yeah, we need stronger ethics laws. Well, again, around lobbying and influence peddling. But we also need to have a better cop on the beat, if you will. The Federal Election Commission was created in the aftermath of the Watergate scandal, and it was set up to serve as kind of the cop, the entity that makes sure that ethics are in place and that things are done legally. But what we have is the way it's structured. There are three Democrats and three Republicans. In today's environment in Washington, with hyper partisanship, they can't agree on anything. So most of the matters that come before the FEC never go anywhere because it's always a 3-3 tie. Nothing ever gets implemented. That needs to change. There needs to be a way to change the makeup of the FEC so that there can really be some action that takes place and that laws are actually enforced.
Right. And actually, I was mistaken. That last one is everyone is held accountable with the FEC.
Right.
Now, it's pretty interesting. You know, the FEC is supposed to, I mean, supposedly these 501c4s, this dark money, the super PACs, maybe I'm mixing them up, but super PACs are not supposed to coordinate with campaigns.
Right.
Just today, the Clinton campaign has filed suit against the Sanders campaign at the FEC, saying that they're getting too much money from individual donors and that there was some kind of coordination between the National Nurses Super PAC and the Sanders campaign. And when I read that, I was struck because I remember reading in your book, Wendell Potter, your book and the one you co-wrote with Nick Penniman in Nation on the Take, that actually Hillary Clinton's super PAC, there was coordination beforehand because, you know, it was all kind of wink, wink, I'm not really running for office, but in fact she really was.
Yeah. Happens all the time. Same thing could be said about the campaign and the super PAC supporting Jeb Bush's candidacy. It happens. It is a wink, wink kind of thing. But the FEC can't do anything because of the gridlock, the dysfunction that defines the FEC. So yes, it's unlawful, but it goes on, and those who engage in that unlawful activity know that they can get away with it.
Right. You say it's the FEC's most broken regulatory body in Washington. Boy, that is saying a lot.
It's saying a heck of a lot, and because there a lot of the regulatory bodies in Washington are captured by the special interest. We write about that as well too, but the FEC is just completely dysfunctional.
Yes, and we don't have enough time to go into all the other areas in which ordinary citizens are being hurt. I mean, you talk about how fossil fuel utilities are trying to stop solar power, the whole involvement in fracking, education. There's a lot of places where we are really being hurt by this, but
right.
We have to leave it there. It's just a terrific book, Nation on the Take, How Big Money Corrupts Our Democracy and What We Can Do About It. Just a last thought. Do you actually think we can do something about it or will do something about it?
I do. I'm optimistic. I think that we can. I think it's going to take a citizen army. I think it can. I think the movement can be created. The last chapter of the book is called "The Making of an All-American Movement." I'm optimistic. I wouldn't have written the book if I didn't believe that it was a possibility and that we can do it.
Well, from your mouth to God's ear. Thanks again, Wendell Potter, for coming on to Writer's Voice.
My pleasure. Thanks so much for having me on.
You can see a video of Wendell Potter and his co-author Nick Penniman talking about Nation on the Take by going to writersvoice.net. has long been obvious to Bernie Sanders supporters that their own party apparatus has conspired to quash his campaign. But until last week, they were called conspiracy theorists. Now that we know the conspiracy is fact, not theory, it's been treated as no big deal, just business as usual, by many in the corporate media. I spoke with journalist Adam Johnson about his piece for the media watch group FAIR. With DNC leaks, former conspiracy theory is now true and no big deal. It's about how the pundits spin inconvenient truths they don't want the public to know or care about. Adam Johnson, welcome to Writer's Voice.
I'm glad to be here. Thanks for having me.
Now, your article with DNC leaks, former conspiracy theory is now true and no big deal. You know, when I first read that title, I was trying to figure out, was that no big deal? Were you being serious about that or not? And I'm glad I went further. What do you mean by no big deal?
Yeah, I did an interview yesterday where the host had clearly not read my article, and she thought I was being serious, which was weird. Yeah, it's obviously sarcastic. So it's what I call the Snowden cycle, or the Edward Snowden cycle, where people assume something's true, and they're kind of dismissed as being conspiracy theorists or nutty, and then their claims are later turn out to be true, and the response is, oh, well, of course it's true, and it's actually not very newsworthy. And you saw this with a lot of the response to the DNC leaks, where for months people were saying the DNC was biased against Sanders, and they were dismissed as kooks and conspiracy theorists. And then when finally these leaks came out that I think pretty much validated it, Debbie Wasserman Schultz had to resign. Donna Brazier formally apologized. So it was kind of, I think officially we kind of knew that the internal workings of the DNC were against Sanders, and the response was, oh, well, of course it's true, but it's obvious. Obviously, the DNC would be biased in favor of Clinton. So there's a certain inconsistency there that I think was worth noting. So I kind of use that as the framing device of this whole scandal.
Why do you think, what's behind this Snowden cycle that you talk about?
It's just PR spin. So the thing is that when you're dealing in a system of limited information, you like understanding the way that the DNC works, which is a very cryptic organization. It's not really clear how it works. It's difficult to prove, to have a smoking gun saying that the DNC was working against Clinton, even though there was lots of circumstantial evidence that they were. Specifically,
and
the
Sanders
debates, the working against debate the Sanders, because the debate schedule was heavily in Clinton's favor. They put it on Sunday night. They put it against, you know, Sunday Night Football early on, which was very popular. And there was an assumption that the DNC was kind of trying to bury Sanders. They liked what Sanders brought to the table. They liked the energy. They liked the donations. But they kind of wanted to make sure that he was relegated to a kind of second-class candidate, along with, you know, Lincoln Chafee and Martin O'Malley. And it was going to be Clinton versus these jokers. So it's sort of difficult to prove that. And then later on, again, when we kind of knew that, the only response is to trivialize it. Again, this is similar to what we saw with Snowden, where, and obviously it's not the same scale, obviously, but it's the same trope. So you say, oh, well, the NSA is collecting everyone's phone calls. Oh, that's insane. You're crazy. You know, cut to June of 2013. By the way, the NSA is collecting everyone's phone calls. And the same people who were calling it crazy said, oh, well, that obviously, clearly the NSA is doing that. There's nothing new here. And the reason they respond that way is because it's the only way left to really spin it as non-trivial. Because when something is news, the only way, the most effective way of diminishing the news is to say it's obvious. Oh, well, obviously, the DNC was in the tank for Clinton. It's not a big deal. It's to be expected. Well, okay, if that's true, that's inconsistent with what you had been saying for the past, you know, for the past year. So that was the way I kind of approached it.
And are they doing the same kind of thing, you think, with these Russian links? I mean, they seem to be throwing out a red herring there. The New York Times headline that I read today assumed that this was true, and yet I've looked at other sites, which, in fact, I think you linked to one, which have some pretty clear critiques of that.
Yes, so there is no publicly available evidence that Russia was buying the leaks. there is several private security firms that have said they are, or rather that the leaks originate from Russia, which of course is not the same thing as saying it's the Russian government. You know, there are 260 million native Russian speakers. There is about, you know, 200 million odd Russians. It's not, by definition, if something happens in Russia, it does not necessarily make it the Russian government. Anonymous has been doing hacks for the last six or seven years in the United States, and no one assumes that they're operating on behalf of the White House. So there are an increasing amount of, there was another, I think, security firm in the Daily Beast today who said, oh, well, yeah, it's the Russians. But again, all these companies thus far have been government contractors of the American government. There is no publicly available evidence that directly links them. And if you kind of look in paragraph, you know, 37 of these articles, they'll basically say as much. So we don't really know. It's possible. It's possible it was Russia. But I think that the assumption that it is plays heavily in favor of the Democratic National Committee in terms of providing a distraction and basically dismissing anyone who kind of runs with these leaks as being a Putin stooge. So I think there's a lot of incentive to emphasize this aspect. And while it may be true, and while, of course, you know, Russia, I guess, dabbling in our electoral process is certainly newsworthy, I think right now there's a lot of assumptions and a lot of conspiracy theory that isn't necessarily backed up. So time will tell. The FBI has apparently launched an investigation. It's a bit curious that they took 6 weeks to do it. But they're supposedly launching an investigation to see if it actually is Russia, but we don't know right now. Right now, what we have is a bunch of circumstantial evidence and I think a very convenient assumptions about the culpability of the Kremlin.
Part of the revelations, the WikiLeaks revelations, were just how much the DNC and the corporate media are intertwined. I wonder if you could comment on that.
Yeah. There's a few episodes where journalists had sent the DNC articles to be basically vetted before they published, which is a bit of an ethically gray area, and all of which were done in favor of Clinton, not Sanders. You see a lot of first-person pronouns in regards to the Clinton campaign from the DNC. The DNC, of course, is supposed to be neutral. And you see a lot of spin against Sanders and against those that were, I guess, not Clinton within the DNC. You saw one instance where they were talking about trying to effectively plant a story without attribution to smear Sanders that was against Sanders. And so you saw a cozy relationship with the press and the DNC vis-a-vis Clinton, which is kind of normal. It's kind of standard. There's nothing necessarily unusual, but it is a gateway into the way in which these things operate. And the actual relationship that was, I guess, friendly wasn't necessarily the story. The story was the fact that it only worked in the direction of Clinton, that there was never, as far as we can see, and we don't have all the emails, but as far as we can see, there is not really anyone at the DNC working with the press in tandem to make Sanders look good. The Sanders is almost a non-issue. And this, of course, is from an organization that was supposed to not take sides in this primary, which they obviously did.
Now, what do you feel about Sanders' reaction? I mean, he seemed to be upset, on the other hand. You know, he's really done very little to try to bring the DNC to account.
Well, Sanders is a team player. You know, he's not going to really, at this juncture, he's not going to go rogue. So his reaction is pretty predictable, which is it sucks, but it's not a surprise. Some of his surrogates have taken more severe language. But, you know, Sanders is lockstep. He's in line. He's trying to get Clinton elected. You know, to editorialize, I think it's a shame. I think that he should probably have said something a little more firm on this. But it's time for the DNC, and he wants to be a good soldier and to, quote-unquote, stop Trump, and that's what he's doing. So he certainly has the right to do that.
In your title, you say, with DNC leaks, former conspiracy theory is now true. Now, conspiracy theory, I wonder if you could talk about that phrase as you know, as something that is used by the corporate media. What are your thoughts on conspiracy theory as an epithet?
Conspiracy theory is a really great catch-all. It's kind of a thing you can say against basically anything that you don't really like. It's similar to terrorism. in that I think the word terrorism can be useful in the abstract. Like, you can describe to me something in the abstract that's terrorism, and I can say, okay, that's terrorism. Sure. But it's so abused, like the word terrorism, and like a lot of other words, that it's been rendered effectively meaningless. So there was a poll last year coming up with the most popular conspiracy theories. And one of them had – one example they used was that that Bush lied about weapons of mass destruction. And then in the same poll, they had one about lizard people. Now, what Bush lied about weapons of mass destruction. This is not a conspiracy theory. This is a matter of historical record. But the fact that they lumped that with literal lizard people indicates the degree to which that term has become a way of basically acting as a kind of epistemological hall monitor. It's a way of policing people's way of understanding the world. So we typically use inference and abstract reasoning to understand the world. We're pattern-seeking mammals, right? For example, I don't have clear-cut evidence that the Harlem Globetrotters games are rigged. I have not seen an internal document knowing that the Harlem Globetrotters have rigged their basketball games against the Washington Generals. But when the Harlem Globetrotters win 100 games out of 100, I can logically infer that the game is rigged. That is not a conspiracy theory. That's inference. So when you see the DNC acting against Sanders for 6 months, you can logically infer that the DNC is biased against Sanders. But there's a thought-terminating cliche to say, oh, well, this is conspiracy theory, because you don't have the internal documents, the smoking gun, to prove it. But any sensible person knows that because, again, we're pattern-seeking mammals. We use inference to understand the world. And people logically assume that. It turns out to be true. And now it's being dismissed as being both obvious and banal. So, and there are several examples of people actually using the term conspiracy theory to mock Sanders' supporters for assuming that the DNC was biased. And I think it's a really interesting term because it is a term that is used to basically shut down conversation. It's a way of saying, you know, you're a lizard person guy, you're Alex Jones, you're insane. And it's like, well, okay, but, you know, again, the Harlem Globetrotters have won 100 games out of 100, so why don't we have a conversation about that?
Wow, that's brilliant. I mean, of course, it's also being used to shut down discussion of electoral fraud during this Democratic primary.
Well, that too. And the electoral fraud issue is something I haven't really dug a lot into, but there is some, I think, evidence of it. There's people who I think are, you know, not crazy people who have made these accusations. But again, the media is so busy running from this story to that, and by the way, that includes myself, that there hasn't really been a lot of people that have kind of dug into it in terms of purging roles and stuff like that. So, you know, what's a conspiracy theory today is conventional wisdom tomorrow, as we've seen over the past 72 hours.
Adam Johnson, this has been a fascinating discussion. Your article is "With DNC Leaks, Former Conspiracy Theory Is Now True and No Big Deal." Thanks so much for talking with us here on Writer's Voice.
You're welcome.
You can find a link to Adam Johnson's article at writersvoice.net. And if you like Writer's Voice, please go to iTunes or your podcast provider and give us a favorable rating. That way, you can spread the good word about our show. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight to your inbox or subscribe to the podcast and the newsletter. And follow us on Twitter at Writer's Voice, all one word. The Writer's Voice webmaster is Bill Way. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.